Out of the earth rises light, rises life, rises spring. May we join with the miracle that is springtime and enter into life with lightness and joy. Out of the Spirit rises faith, rises hope, rises love. May we join with the miracle that is Easter time and enter into life with hope and love. Let us resurrect with spring. Let us resurrect with the Spirit and enter into renewed life as we gather into our time of worship together this Easter morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We are a religion, but we have no prophet. We have faith, but we have no creed. We have respect for texts from many religions, but we have no sacred book. We come together in common belief in the seven principles printed on the order of service to search for truth and meaning, to celebrate life together, and to work to make the world a better place. Whatever your spiritual beliefs, whoever you love, you are welcome here. If you'd like to know more, ask anyone after the service, and be sure to ask more than one person, as you're sure to get more than one good answer. I call your attention to the announcements in the order of service, and in addition, a couple others. There will be a potluck brunch after the service. For any visitors that didn't bring something, you're still certainly very welcome to stay. This month in the newsletter, we'll have published information about what will be voted on at the annual meeting, including the slate of candidates for the board and the proposed budget. So keep an eye out for that in the April newsletter. There will be a film for the next seven generations. It'll be shown at the K-State Student Union Forum Hall tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. This is a cultural documentary on the International Council of the 13 Indigenous Grandmothers, one of whom will be an elder at the Flint Hills Wisdom Keepers during the last weekend in April at White Memorial Camp near Council Grove. See Pat Embers or Diane Barker if you'd like more information about that. And in case you don't know, election day for local city council, city commission, and school board elections is Tuesday, April 2nd. So if you haven't already, please be sure to vote. As we gather to celebrate together, we light the chalice to connect us to the other Unitarian Universalist congregations across the country and around the world. May it be a light to you in dark places when all other lights go out. Each Sunday, we set aside time in our service to bring our joys and our sorrows into the embrace of this loving community. If you have a joy or concern, please raise your hand so Doug can bring you the microphone.
My joy is that my dad came back from Afghanistan.
My joy is partly that there are so many old familiar faces, old friends back here. It's wonderful to see people. But my personal joy is that my son in Minnesota now is employed. Oh, boy. And he and my granddaughter are going to visit me next week. So that's...
Hello, everyone. Molly McGoy. My joy is that we received a metronome. It's really not an old-fashioned one. It's kind of a new one. But anyway, a metronome with a pendulum in the mail from Stephen Moll, all the way from New York, just for Nick. And we learned how to operate it and make it go faster and slower and had just a wonderful discussion about it yesterday. So Stephen and Marilyn are still taking care of us, even though they are no longer here.
In El Forester, my joy was that I had a great day yesterday with my great-grandkids and visiting with my granddaughter as well. And the other thing is, I second his, if you live in Manhattan, vote as if your life depended on it, because it does. Encourage your neighbors, your family members, anybody you know. This is very, very, very important. I do want to add that the people in Germany did not realize what was going on till it was too late. And we are very close to that kind of crisis. So I cannot emphasize it more.
Thanks,
please,
ma'am.
Make it a joy next Sunday.
I'm Elke Lorenz. I just wanted to share with you, since we have been talking about Stephen Moll. Stephen is in the hospital. He had some fainting spells, and he has a lesion on his brain, which did not cause the fainting. So they are doing all kinds of tests with him right now.
Taylor Bachman, Joy, my mother and father, Yvonne and Russ, are here visiting for Easter.
By sharing, joys are amplified and the burdens of concerns are lightened. For those joys and concerns that were shared and for those that were not, we keep each other in our hearts. Now please stand as you are able, as Dick Beeman will lead us in our first song. The words are printed in your order of service.
The tune to this song is a familiar one to all, or so I thought until I did a random poll of a few people this morning and found out nobody knows the tune. Fortunately, Larry's over there. He's going to sing loudly with me, I'm sure. Jesus Christ was a man who traveled through the land, hardworking man and brave. He said to the rich, "Give your money to the poor." So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. But the cops and legislators called them dangerous agitators, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, and told them all the same. Sell all your jewelry, give your money to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. But the cops and legislators called them dangerous agitators, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus came to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. So the bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross, and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. But the cops and legislators called them dangerous agitators, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. This song was written in New York City, of rich man, preacher, and slave. Yes, if Jesus preached today like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. But the cops and legislators called them dangerous agitators, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave.
All right, now will the children come forward so Kathleen can share a story with everyone.
want to hold it?
Okay, well, you know what? Maybe I can have someone hold it for me.
Good morning.
Nope, not yet.
Good morning. Wow, we've got a big crowd today. It's great to see everybody. Morning, guys. What's happening outside? What does it finally feel like? Yes, spring and Easter, that's right. How can you tell that it's spring outside? Yeah?
And also the sun is brighter.
The sun is brighter?
And
nice. It's not cold as much.
The weather is warming up.
It's warming up, and there's lots of green. That's right. What, Jake? What? Jake has something to say.
I got a book that was called a science book.
Yes. Jake got a science book. It sounds really cool.
And it has a book, too.
Awesome. Can I ask you guys some questions first? So what's in spring, there's lots of changes, right? What do you guys do if you want to change something? What kinds of things can you do to make something change? Connor?
Make a petition.
Make a petition. Tucker, Carter.
Be good.
To be good. I like that one. Jake.
Make eggs.
Okay. Are there any other ways you can change? What if you had a big group of people and they all had to make a decision? How could you all work to change something? Indigo.
You could vote.
That's really important coming up this week, isn't it? I'm going to talk about a change. I'm going to read this book called The Curious Garden today. And there's another way we can change. And this is a story about a little boy who leads by example. Okay? Perk, what do you want to say? You sure? Okay, we can talk about it later. Okay, this is a book I got from Jessica Long, Katie and Colton's mom. I'm going to skip some pages, so bear with me, okay? Okay. There was once a city without gardens or trees or greenery of any kind. Most people spent their time indoors. As you can imagine, it was a very dreary place. Looks pretty dull, huh? Yeah. You know what? Maybe I'll switch a little bit. Is that better? Okay. There was a little boy who still loved to be outside. His name was Liam. You could always find Liam outside, happily splashing through his neighborhood. He liked to discover things, and it was one morning he made a very special discovery. He ran up the stairs of the old railway tracks. That was the biggest. He really was excited to explore those railway tracks, and he found some plants. He actually found some wildflowers, but they kind of looked sick, like they might need some help. So he started to become a gardener. See the little plants there? He didn't really know how to be a gardener, but he taught himself. He started pruning and watering, and as the weeks rolled by, he began to feel like a real gardener, and the plants began to feel like a real garden. See that? You guys see that? Over the next few months, Liam and the Curious Garden explored every corner of the railway system. See, it got bigger. Just from Liam. Look at that. Yep, there's grass on the railroad tracks. There's flowers.
Everywhere.
You think there's too many? I don't know. After spending his spring and summer and autumn with the garden, Liam's time on the railway was finally interrupted by winter. Heavy blankets of snow fell on the city that season. Rather than waste his winter worrying about the garden, Liam spent it preparing for spring. Wow, he kept positive, didn't he? Winter had taken its toll on the garden. But thanks to Liam's planning, his handy new tools, and a little help from the sun, the plants soon awoke from their winter sleep. The garden had always wanted to explore the rest of the city, and that spring, it was finally ready to make its move. Once again, the tough little weeds and mosses set out first. They popped up farther and farther from the railway, and they were closely followed by the more delicate plants. They're there. See? They're moving. They're coming up in crazy places like cracks in the sidewalk, right? Places where they're not really supposed to. A few plants popped up where they didn't belong. Others mysteriously popped up all at once. Who's that? But the most surprising thing that popped up were the new gardeners. Isn't that cool? There's so many of them. They're following in Liam's footsteps. Yep. See them on the bottom? These are just some pictures, guys. Yeah.
I can't see if there's two houses. Oh, look, the animals are following
me. Yes, they're plant animals. Many years later, the entire city had blossomed. But of all the new gardens, Liam's favorite was where it all began. He made a lot of things happen, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yes. You guys are curious gardeners too. And you may not grow a garden, but you're going to grow things in your future. So. Yes?
I don't have a garden at my house, but I grow them.
Okay.
I don't know how to grow them.
Well, we're going to send you off.
But I help a guy garden.
You do help a guy garden?
And my outside in the dirt.
All right.
Your friend Catherine?
She brought some chicks.
She did. Well, there's lots of ways to grow things, right? So you're going to go to class this morning and learn about more things that you can use. You can affect change in this world, can't you? All right.
We take inspiration from the wisdom of many religious traditions. But to do that, we have to know something about them. So here's some information you might not have known. Easter gets its name from the Teutonic goddess of spring and the dawn, whose name is variously Esther, Ustra, or as modern pagans have generally accepted, Ostara, which honors this goddess as the word for the vernal equinox. Vernal equinox usually falls somewhere between March 19th and 22nd, and depending on when the first full moon on or after the equinox occurs, Easter falls sometime between late March and mid-April. The earth reawakens to a burgeoning new season of life-giving, life-affirming gifts. As the sun becomes stronger, there is a sense of joyful abundance. With the end of the cold, dark months, ancient pagans no longer needed to store food. Often the tastiest cured meats were presented to the spring celebrations and feasts as a sign that the people no longer needed to stockpile. The equinox was recognized worldwide as a time for renewal, rebirth, and revivification. It was the celebration of the symbolic resurrection of Earth itself, Christ, and Hathor of Egypt, to name a few. Passover, which occurs in the middle of the Hebrew month of Nisan, is one of Judaism's most important festivals. In ancient times, the holiday coincided with the spring harvest. Later on, the holiday commemorated the Exodus from Egypt in the 13th century BC. Ostara and the egg she carries are symbols of fertility, of new and continuing life. Some descriptions say Esther herself is hare-headed and the goddess of rabbits and birds. The hare is also associated with the moon in many cultures, due in part to its nighttime eating habits and in part to the image of one on the moon. Whether Esther herself is hare-headed or her attendants are hares, she is strongly associated with the hare and later its cousin, the rabbit, for obvious reasons. A popular myth says that the children of the time presented eggs to the goddess as a gift in return for her bringing them the spring. She was so touched by this gift that she recruited her minions, the rabbits, to return the eggs, now brightly colored, to the children in baskets, the birds' nests. And that's where the tradition of rabbits delivering eggs to children comes from. Eggs also represent fertility and the promise of new life. The Celts often dyed eggs red to symbolize the menstruation cycle. While dyeing the eggs, women and children would think carefully on their hopes and wishes for the coming year. They would bury the eggs alongside a seedling in the ground to sustain and feed the plant through its growing season. As the plant grew, the hope or wish would also take root and come to fruition at the end of the year. It's been reported that when Christianity came to the Northern Isles, the priests and bishops, not approving of such a pagan practice, would encourage children to seek out and dig up the eggs. When the children would bring them back to the church, the clergy would pay them a small token for each egg collected, and hence the Easter egg hunt was born. So as we all celebrate new life and new possibility, let us all be mindful of the similarities of the celebrations of so many groups. Now we will accept the offering. As we gather together on this Easter Sunday, we have an opportunity to consider how Jesus' teachings influence us today. His message of caring for everyone and caring for the poor still resonates with our values of the worth and dignity of all people and the quest for justice and compassion in human relations. We are called to act on these values, and to act we must understand. Dr. Jim Chereau is a professor of history at K-State and a current Manhattan City Commissioner, at least for several more days. He is sharing his unique inside perspective on issues our community is likely to face over the next 2 years between Tuesday's City Commission and School Board elections and the next ones of 2015. Please welcome Dr. Chereau.
Well, it certainly is a pleasure to be here this morning, and I can't imagine a pastor or a leader of a congregation giving up an Easter Sunday to a legislator who has just been rightly characterized in a Woody Guthrie hymn that you just sang. It's kind of worrisome about being up here. But I'm just kind of struck by the song that just played, "Be Careful What You Ask For." When I ran for city commission, I thought I knew what I was asking for, but I find out from time to time I don't. But what I do try to remember is some teachings in the Tao. And be like a river flowing downstream toward a goal. And when you encounter boulders and obstacles, go around them and then come back together and continue on your journey. That's kind of how I think about things right now. We've met some obstacles, but now it's time for the stream to come back together, go around the boulders, come back together, and flow on downstream toward our goals. And I've thought about, you know, what those goals were for me. And certainly, I had in mind community prosperity, taking care of those who have difficulty taking care of themselves. And that's been a difficult thing to accomplish. And I think about ethics in many kind of ways always when I'm taking my votes. And I was struck by a piece that was published in the New York Times today. It's by Matthew Hudson. He's a psychologist. And he wrote a piece called "Our Inconsistent Ethical Instincts." And I thought, boy, that strikes a nerve. And he talked about two instincts that most of us have. A utilitarian perspective, which says, if it does good, it is good. And then there's the other one, a deontological approach, which he says takes into account aspects of the action itself, like whether or not it adheres to certain rules. Do not kill, for example, even if killing does good. So there's sort of two ways of looking at ethics. And then he said something else that really has bothered me my entire time on the commission. And he wrote, upper income people tend to have less empathy than those from lower income strata and are so more willing to sacrifice individuals for the greater good. And I thought, every time I've taken a vote, I've wondered how my vote factors into that, that notion that doing the greater good sacrifices individuals. When I first started in this line, I wanted to have better income redistribution. I know that's a nasty word to a lot of people, but I did. And I thought, what's the best way to implement taxation in our community? And I thought, those who prosper and do well by benefit of living in our community should and do have a higher obligation to support that community. And those who have lesser of an opportunity to do that or can't do that need not share that burden. And I thought an income tax, a progressive income tax, and a lot of cities and other places do this sort of thing. I thought that would be a good approach here in Manhattan. But I found out some boulders are pretty big. And the state legislature, actually, since cities are a legal creature of the state, we are forbidden by state statute from implementing city income tax in Kansas. So that was out of the question for following that line. So what's the best way of taxation? Well, for me, it's property taxes, because that comes closer to a progressive form of income tax than anything else we do. Because if you own a $2 million home in town, obviously you have more wherewithal than somebody who has simply a $100,000 home. And you have benefited from this city and its services to a much greater degree. And so don't you have a social obligation back to the community good as a result of that? It's not punitive. It's sharing in the common good. I'll repeat that. It's not punitive. But yet we have people who consider property taxes a great burden on people who shouldn't be bearing that. So what's their approach? Well, let's put into effect sales taxes. And that's what's happened in this community. But how do sales taxes play out for the regular person? They play out this way. If you make $30,000, you pay the same amount of sales taxes on a loaf of bread that somebody who is making $300,000 does. But yet, you don't have the wherewithal to pay it as the person who makes $300,000 a year. The taxation is the same regardless of how much you make. And the burden is disproportionately shared by those who have less and lesser shared by those who have more. But that's the approach we've taken in this city. We primarily fund the city and its services through sales taxes. I've asked my students in my classes how much they support the city and do they know where their money's going to. And I usually find out that they don't know where it's going to at all. But I ask them how many of them pay sales taxes, and they all raise their hands. I ask them how many pay property taxes, and none of their hands go up. I ask them how many of them are renters, and nearly all their hands go up. And I inform them that indeed they are paying property taxes. They're just doing it through their rent. But they're paying it. It's not the person who owns the property who is paying it, even though they're legally obligated. So always I'm thinking about that issue here that was brought up by Hudson. In pursuing the public good, how often are individuals sacrificed in the pursuit of that common good? And that's been one of the hardest things for me to grapple with as a legislator. And I would have hoped, had I been around at the time of Christ, I wouldn't have been the one to put him on the cross. But who knows? And when I think about some of the issues that I have faced as a commissioner, and I'll go through a couple of them, or a few of them, and then I'll be happy to entertain questions. But one of the ones that I thought where people were most disadvantaged was with rental inspections. My wife and I have restored several properties in the community. And each one of them, aside from one, had been a rental. And when we entered each one of those, not one of them would have passed code inspection. But by city ordinance, every single rental in this community needs to be code compliant. It's city ordinance. The question is enforcement. And what I saw too often were service people who were renting, students who were renting, people coming in who don't have a lot of money to put for a down payment on a home. Those people were being victimized far too often by irresponsible, unethical landlords. And I simply had had enough. This issue had been around in our city for over a quarter century. The first person who advocated rental inspections in this community was Kent Glasscock when he was mayor. And at the time, his family owned what was called Home Store Lumber Company here in town, where Mead Lumber Company is today. And that's when the Landlord Association was organized, is right at that time. And they informed Kent Glasscock that their industry would no longer buy anything from his lumber company if he pursued rental inspections as an ordinance. That's pretty powerful. In a city that has right now about 65% of its housing units are rentals. That's pretty powerful economic threat to a lumber company. It didn't go anywhere. And it came back from time to time. When President McCain was president of our university, there were similar concerns about rental inspections and students being in safe housing. And when I was on a city commission, it changes every 2 years. And the first one, when I was advocating it, I asked my fellow commissioners, I said, which one of you wants to confront a family who has lost a loved one in a rental because it wasn't code compliant? And you could have taken a step to make sure that that could happen. Which one of you wants to explain that to that family? But still, there was an unwillingness to do it. We finally have had a commission that was willing to do that. And we implemented it. And it took a year to register nearly 11,000 properties here in the community. And then the code inspectors were doing their work. And the kind of things that the code inspectors found were really appalling. Imagine an electrical circuit box on the outside of a rental without any covering to it. Those were the kinds of things that they were discovering that definitely, you know, affects the safety of people who are in rentals. You cannot imagine how it feels being mayor of the community and having a new set of commissioners come in and rescinding what had taken a quarter century to put into place. But that was the fate that I experienced, and you go on. You try to go around the boulder. Bus transportation was another one. A fixed route system in this community actually saves taxpayer money. And the demand response system is about, well, it's over $3.50 per ride, whereas the fixed route system hovers around $1.50 or $2. So from a taxpayer's position, it seems to make sense. Put in the fixed route system and lower the cost of the system altogether. But no, people don't deserve that. A mere $15,000 was asked for from the commission to subsidize the bus system, a fixed route system in the community, $15,000. And that was refused because it could have greater implications for the taxpayers of this community. And when they say taxpayers, they mean property taxpayers. And they don't mean everybody who's paying property taxes. They mean the person who is legally the legal property owner of the property itself. And so I thought, okay, the county's going to make up this difference. What I'll do is I'll work to try to make sure that at least in the public right-of-ways, that they can put up the signs so that people know where the bus is going to stop. I thought that could be a sensible idea. It wasn't going to cost the city commission anything. And again, they refused to do that. There's a very interesting side story that goes along with this too, where I felt there was a possible violation of the Kansas Open Meetings Act, and that I did have investigated by our county attorney. It was found out that, well, maybe there could have been, but it wasn't absolutely positive that it did, and so it was kind of allowed to go by the side. But at least I put them on notice that three of them should not be discussing things and making up their policy decisions prior to coming into commission meetings. When I looked at social services, I was appalled by how little we put into social services and what great return it has to our community in terms of taking care of primarily children, not adults, but primarily children. And when I heard a couple of commissioners, Commissioners Mata and Butler both, saying that the city had no business being in providing social services, that it was not a public responsibility, I thought, well, what is? But they didn't believe that was to be. And I felt fortunate that in this last budget, we were able to provide social service funding for the applicants who the Social Service Advisory Board approved. We were able to save those at a 5% reduction. There was no need for that. By and large, we're a very wealthy community. And very little, hardly pennies, of a property tax bill that any of us pays goes into those social services. Most all that's funded by sales taxes, once again. But I never felt like the facts ever got in the way of political ideology when we were sitting on the commission. I think the most distressing one for me, I mean, social services was distressing enough, but at least it was saved. But was the rescinding of LGBT protections in our community. I saw that purely as a civil rights issue, and I wanted to see those protections remain in place It just made sense to me. The university already has those protections. The Army and the Department of Defense policies now have those protections. Why in the world couldn't we have those protections here in this city? And I think if I did the political analysis right, it was distressing to me to find that people who said they were pastors or associated with about 26 churches in our community signed a protest to the passage of that ordinance. 26. I didn't quite think that was in keeping with Jesus' practices, but what do I know about theology? So, but yet that was the case. And so when you had the Landlord Association, that class of Christian thinking, I hate to call it Christian thinking, but I'll call it that. And when you have people on the other side of the political spectrum who don't think that the city should be doing anything but, quote, core functions like police and fire and streets and that's it, then you're going to be in for a rough political election. And that's what I feared 2 years ago. When we passed the commission that I was on, when Bruce Sneed, who was mayor at the time, Jamie Morris Hardiman, who was a commissioner along with me and myself, when we passed LGBT protections, there was a lot of celebration out in the foyer. And this is the message I want to leave with all of you. There was a lot of celebration, and I understood it, and I was happy for the celebrants. But I asked the leadership, I said, I can help implement this ordinance. I could help pass it, and I'm very happy that I did. But I said, now it's up to you to protect it. It's up to you to protect it. I can't do that by myself. I'm one vote. And when I go to the polls in the next election, I will be one vote. It will be up to you to protect it. And it wasn't. It wasn't. I know that when Phil Anderson ran, he supported it. And he supported rental inspections. Had Phil Anderson been elected, none of the recensions of rental inspections or LGBT protections, none of that would have happened had he been elected. But that's not the case, is it? But how many people turned out to work for Phil, to walk streets and neighborhoods for Phil, to get that job done? And sometimes that's what it takes. Sometimes that's what it takes. Being a commissioner has taught me a lot about ethics, politics, and how to protect the common interests without putting undue burdens and making sacrifices of people who are not in a position to protect themselves. It's been a difficult struggle, but I hope that in my time I've done some good. And I hope that we put commissioners into place who will continue to do good. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Yes.
Hey, Jim, we have to follow the mic.
Jim Chantel. There was a well-publicized incident apparently that occurred between you and somebody in a restaurant, and I'm curious if you would elaborate so it's not the kind of cryptic way that the Mercury described it.
Okay. A couple things, and what The name of the restaurant has come out, so everybody knows it happened at the Little Grill. So, I mean, that's where it happened. I chastised Brad Schoen a little bit for even making that much of it public. Because I reminded him, I said, I'm not in the same league with the president, obviously. But I said, when the Secret Service finds out that there's a threat somewhere, they don't go out and publicize who it is, where it's going to happen, or anything else. That's not the way the Secret Service works, to protect the president. And I said, besides, it wasn't about the person. It was about the rhetoric. And the rhetoric concerned me. Because I heard that same rhetoric on the commission in a milder, gentler way, yes, but I hear the same thing. This guy had just taken it to an extreme. Do I consider him somewhat dangerous? Yes, I do. Do I consider him to be a stable member of our community? I rather think not. That was certainly my impression that night. And so that was it. It was the rhetoric. The rhetoric that's saying, especially when I told him, well, you won't have to worry about this much longer. You can rest easy. I won't be a commissioner after the 16th. And he said, I won't rest easy until people like you and other people who think like you are no longer in power. We will be taking over this country. And I thought, you know, that's not a pleasant way to end a conversation. But that's the way it ended. And this kind of rhetoric is dangerous. There's just no question about it. We can have our political differences. And I'm constantly reminded that when I make a vote as a commissioner, when I take a vote, I haven't pleased one person. I haven't pleased everybody in town. Sometimes I wonder if I pleased anyone, but I know that I have not pleased everyone. You can't do that. So there are always going to be differences, even among well-meaning people. But that's no way to approach them. And we've seen enough of this trying to implement social change through violence and through kind of harsh rhetoric. I mean, we've seen enough of that in this country. I'd like to think, as civilized people, maybe we're hopefully starting to get beyond that. But it makes you wonder from time to time.
Yeah.
Yes, Bryce.
Bryce Hobrock. A similar thing happened to me one time, and in talking to an attorney, it really constituted a terrorist threat that very well could have been prosecuted. But that wasn't what I wanted to say. I just wanted to answer you what you said in saying, have I done any good? Yes, you have done good. And all of us thank you for your service over the last several years on the commission. So at least there are many of us who appreciate what you've done. I've had a chance to interact with the commission over the last few months regarding the expansion of the public library children's room, as you know. We're doing okay for the moment unless the election turns out poorly, at which point, if you read the letters today, there are several interests that are going to sink this if they can. How yeah. dare those people want to increase my taxes? I've been thinking about the speech I would make in front of the commission, and I dare not do that, but I can do it here.
In some respects, Bryce, I encourage you to do that before the commission. I just want to interrupt just one second. What is so important, and a lot of you do not realize, that your voice heard at the podium, even if you are saying something that the commission thinks is heard over and over again, that voice is important to be heard. Mm-hmm. Let me remind you, that voice, your voice, is important to be heard. Mm-hmm. Bryce.
Okay, this won't take long. Two metaphors which I'm going to mix. One of them is the elephant in the room, and the other is the elephant and the mouse, which elephants fear greatly, of course. Having watched the chairman of the Landlords Association and some of the commissioners in action, I can only think in terms of absurdities. And that one of those is the elephant dancing around, hiking up his skirts, the little mouse, which is a library, scurrying around, asking for a crumb, and the elephant is trumpeting in fear. And that's about what it amounts to. The library project is so small, and we have raised $1 million of private money to take care of nearly half of it, and yet we have these elephants who are acting like the mouse is just going to tear them apart.
Yeah. Bryce is absolutely right. If Mr. Ball or Hogan, especially, are elected, or even former Commissioner Strawn, you could probably kiss the library project goodbye. The three of us, Mayor Peppard, Rich Jankovich, myself, have pushed the library project ahead as far as we can. But there's still a couple other pieces in it that are still left to be decided by the next commission. And they'll be the ones deciding whether or not it continues to go forward. John?
Jim, could you tell us how wide the opposition is to rental inspections in Manhattan? Is it just the Landlords Association, or is there, you know, all of the small, you know, mom and pop rental property owners who have, you know, an apartment or one kind or another?
The, in fact, the large property owners, the very large ones, and the ones especially building new, they're actually, they don't have any trouble with it. In fact, they prefer to see it. And I'll explain the economics of it real quickly, if I may. Let's say you're Tim Schultz, and you build a new apartment complex here in town. You are building up to code standards, modern code standards, right away. And you're paying higher price for materials, too. I mean, each month that goes by, there's a little inflation in material costs. And they're putting in quality materials. So they have apartments that are very clean, code compliant, and they're pricey. Now, let's say you're a landlord here in wards 1 or 2 or 3 or 5 even, and you haven't put any money into your property. It's not code compliant, and you know it. But you know you can raise your rents because there's 95% occupancy in town. So you know you can raise your rents even $25, $30, $50 less than Schultz for building new, and you can still command it because of the tight market. And you don't have to put any money into your place. And the more it looks run down from the outside, when the county appraiser comes by, the value of the house goes down. So you're paying less in property taxes. You've actually become a greater burden on the community, and just from purely an economic standpoint. So the people who run the large apartment complexes, they don't have any problem with it. It's the smaller, and there's a lot of them, the smaller landlords who are really adamantly opposed to it. And they have most of the properties, you know, I mean, some of them have anywhere from 50 to 80 properties. I mean, it's, and then if you can attach that to the boogeyman of big government, then you got an issue. Yeah, Mike.
Mike Benalla. The last election, there was some financial backing of two candidates by the Landlords Association. I would assume that is happening again this election.
Yes.
Admittedly, kind of stayed away from it.
No, the Landlord Association has its own PAC. But there's a lot of PACs out there. For example, the Firemen's Union, they have their own PAC that operates out of Kansas City. It's a political PAC. And they've also contributed. So the Landlord Association, the Builders Association, both those put quite a bit of money into certain candidates.
Is there any documentation of that that could be easily found by a person like myself to
Yes, those are public records.
Pages and things?
Yeah, there's regular reporting of that, Mike, but oftentimes it doesn't come out right at the timing with city elections and so forth. But, yeah, you can go down to the county office tomorrow, and they need to pull up that information. It's all public, the financial reporting. But the financial reporting only comes in every so often. So let's say from the last report, that was just a few weeks ago, up to now, a lot of people could be contributing money, but it's not going to come out until after the election in the next reporting cycle. Yes?
A few years ago, there was an organization called... Sorry. A few years ago, there was an organization called Citizens for a Better Manhattan. There has been an organization called Our Manhattan, which has the kind of clout that we've just been talking about, and is also a PAC, and is extremely visible, and is probably one that's disseminating, and I'm saying this, you aren't, that's disseminating a lot of information and misinformation through organizations like churches. I'm saying it, you aren't.
Okay.
Why have we not been able to pull together on our side an organization with that much influence? And why can I think we're just on the verge of doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I can't understand why Citizens for a Better Manhattan dissolved. And I believe it had a lot of impact in bringing much better representation into all of our governmental, well, entities.
That's an excellent question. In 2004, before the 2005 election, I was part of a small group that actually helped put together Citizens for a Better Manhattan. And it came apart for a few reasons. One, the Mercury really did not do it any good service. It simply didn't. And I have chastised Ned Seaton about that and asked him, you know, why don't you do the same kind of investigative editorial work with Our Manhattan that you did with Citizens for a Better Manhattan? And didn't get a good answer to that. But so that was part of it. It also came apart because it was starting to draw in business people who were concerned about the direction of the city in some previous commissions. But then they started splitting out of it because they were concerned about the Living Wage Coalition also being a part of it. So they weren't willing to embrace that. Even though I've spoken to a lot of business people and said, you know, even if from a social perspective, if you let's just take that out of it. From an economic perspective, it seems to me that the living wage push is in your benefit as a taxpayer. So I tried to spell out even the economic returns to it, which a lot of business people in our community are concerned about, rather than the social ramifications. So the Living Wage Coalition also separated out. At the time, the smoking ordinance was also a very divisive issue that this community decided strongly with the citizen petition ordinance, and which I was very thankful to see. But those issues pulled apart Citizens for a Better Manhattan and the treatment it received in the press. And it just never was able to pull itself back together. I would like to think when I see where national polls are going with certain issues now, that a lot of this will be overcome. We've made substantial progress, I think, in making sure now that at least the economic incentives are going to companies that are paying decent wages. I haven't seen one that has fallen below the thresholds that that the Living Wage Coalition would oppose. So we've made progress there. I think people are getting used to it. They're realizing that the city's economy is not falling apart as a result. And so I think given where the Supreme Court decisions may come down with DOMA and the California suit, we're seeing a sea change in public attitudes. And it's going to take people realizing their common interests here in the community and pulling together, understanding that they can do this. It'll come back.
Sir, yes. My name's Sabrina Boker. I'd like to vote in the city elections, but the problem is I live in Ogden. So is there any way I can influence the elections by what can I do to help?
Yeah.
Because I can't vote in the city elections, or I would.
If there are still candidates walking neighborhoods, do a literature drop for them. That's one way that you can actually do that. And it's very effective. I found that out when I had good people walking neighborhoods for me. As a candidate, you can't get around to all neighborhoods during an election. I mean, it's just impossible. So you got to have real supporters who are going out there and going door to door. And those precincts where I had good door to door campaigning, I did very, very well. So that does make a huge difference. Drew, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for coming very much. All right, please stand again as you are able, and we will follow Dick once again. The closing song is number 1017 in the Teal Hymnal, Building a New Way.
Pretty sure this song is unfamiliar to most of us, so let me sing the first verse. And then we'll sing all four verses after that. We are building a new way. We are building a new way. We are building a new way, feeling stronger every day. We are building a new way. We are building a new way. We are building a new way, feeling stronger every day. We are building a new way. We are working to be free. We are working. We are working to be free from hate and greed and jealousy. We are working to be free. We can feed our every need. We can feed our every need. We can feed our every need. Start with love, that is the seed. We can feed our every need. Peace and freedom is our prize. Peace and freedom is our prize. Peace and freedom is our cry. Without these, the world will die. Peace and freedom is our prize.
Next time, it'll be more familiar.
All right, everybody enjoy the potluck. Thank you.